Well, that was my special guest live in the studio, and he is one of Sydney's finest saxophonists, one of the busiest on the music scene. He's involved with a number of bands and projects across genres, but approaches his music from a solid jazz bedrock that informs much of his output. Most recently, he tapped into the spirit of legendary saxophonist Mark Simmons with a tribute to the iconic Australian jazz album Fire. His abiding project, however, is the Ethio Jazz Ensemble Mr. Ott, which last year, I think, released its third album. Matt Ottignon, welcome to Now's the Time.
Hi, Frank. Glad to be here.
Matt, it is true that you're one of the busiest artists in Sydney, and that's proof the fact that it's been 13 years since you've been in this chair.
Wow, has it been that long?
13 years, that's right.
Wow.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to fill the gap, what you've been doing in that 13-year period. But we know you've been performing with the Java Quartet and Compass and numerous other ensembles and genres. But before we chat about Mr. Ott, let's recap somewhat on how you made your way to from New Zealand to us here in Sydney as a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
You fell under the spell of Mike Nock.
Taking me way back. Yeah, so I came over here to study jazz, as so many people from outside Sydney have done. And I'd met Mike Nock through some workshops in Auckland, and I knew that he was teaching in Sydney. And at that time, Auckland, in fact, even New Zealand, didn't have a jazz degree. So I was like, okay, this is great. Mike suggested it would be a good idea, and I got in, and the first year or two was just so eye-opening for me to be in this massive, big city, like much bigger city with a really robust scene at the time. I remember going and hanging out the Strawberry Hills Hotel to see a lot of great bands that were playing there on Fridays and Saturdays when SEMA was back then. Was situated back then, and there was a whole heap of other jazz venues around too, so it was quite a great time to go out and see music. I'd be able to go and see Bernie McGann and Phil Slater and all these other great cats, and through doing the concert practices in front of Mike, you know, every couple of months or something, we'd put one on. He invited me to go on tour with him, I think the end of my second year or beginning of my third year at the con, and that was incredible, with Brett Hurst on bass and Chris O'Connor on drums, who is a Wellington-based drummer. And we did this incredible tour all the way through New Zealand, and I never toured through New Zealand. I hadn't even been to some of these towns before. I'd never been to the South Island before. And so not only did I get to be on stage with someone who's experienced as Mike and who'd played with some of my heroes like Yusuf Lateef, I also got to go and explore like the glaciers and go and have yummy mussel dishes down on the south coast of New Zealand. So, yeah.
Well, clearly you must have been into jazz to a certain degree before that meeting even occurred. Who was your greatest influence in terms of saxophone players? What got you into music? I know you come from a musical family.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's it. I was, I guess, fortunate to grow up in a household where we had my dad had John Coltrane records lying around. And he would really encourage us to play jazz by bringing home like Jamie Abersol play-alongs so we could go busking with them down on the street. And, you know, the Branford Marcellus album came out once, and he bought that for us, you know, as we were really young kids. And I guess I grew up sort of hearing jazz in the household more than any other style of music. You know, like that was absolutely the start of it all. And my dad used to play saxophone and flute when he was a lot younger, when he sort of escaped and ran away to London and ended up jamming and playing with Manfred Mann, who was a jazz pianist, at a little jazz gig in London at the time, out at Barnes. And so there was that, you know, there's this sort of like history of my dad doing that, and he ended up being an architect and coming back and living in Auckland and not, you know, performing or anything. But as soon as I was old enough, he got me playing flute and then alto, and then my brother played clarinet and sax, and then Aaron, my other brother, played saxophone first and then piano, and it just went from there. And then my sister ended up playing saxophone, and yeah, and then I'd go and see some gigs in Auckland, a young guy called Nathan Haynes, or he's a few years older than me, was a big influence at the time. But I got really into Charlie Parker and John Coltrane and Miles Davis from a really young age. I was like, just absolutely loved listening to the albums when I was in my early teens.
So fast forward, and you come to Sydney, and as I mentioned, you're performing with various ensembles here. The Java Quartet comes to mind, the Compass Saxophone Quartet comes to mind. But suddenly you become interested and influenced by Ethiopian jazz or Ethio jazz.
Yeah.
What was the catalyst for that?
Well, I've thought about that a bit, and it happened in a couple of interesting sort of stages. I'd never heard of it until I was probably towards the end of my jazz degree, still very much into modern jazz. And my older brother, Mark, I've got three brothers and a sister, but my older brother, Mark, had always given me mixtapes since I was a kid. And on a lot of those mixtapes were people like Yusuf Lateef, so that's why I was really influenced by him. But then I remember, like, he gave me another tape or a CD, I think it was a tape at the time, of an Ethiopian compilation of Mulatu songs. Mulatu Astatke, who is the guy who invented Ethio jazz. You know, he went over to London and studied music, studied jazz, and came back and melded it with his traditional scales and rhythms to create this beautiful style of music in the 60s. And that compilation sounded so interesting to me at the time. It was like quite different sounding, but lovely. And the recordings had a classic sort of sound to them, like almost lo-fi, but warm and dirty and dusty. Certainly don't sound like they're recorded in Columbia, you know, like a Miles Davis Columbia recording. It's much raw lo-fi, and quite funky and soulful. And then I was doing like just a fun little gig on King Street in Newtown at the local Irish pub there, and with some family and friends, and we're just playing like a little groove. I don't think it was Ethiopian, but it might have been. We were just doing a little sort of funky little groove, and Derib Desalegn walked in, who's this great Ethiopian singer. Some people might know him, Derib the Ambassador.
Yes.
And he just walked in off the street and started singing. He grabbed a mic and off he went. And we're like, whoa, what's going on here? And then disappeared. Like, no, we didn't get numbers or anything. It was just like, wow, that was great. That was cool. What happened? And so we just, popped that away in the memory banks. And then another couple of years later, I got called up to fill in for Peter Farah to play in Derib's band. And then I really sunk my teeth into the Ethiopian stuff. So there's a few little things.
Yeah. Well, there's a story in itself with Mulatu, isn't there? I mean, I read that he went to London not to pursue music, but to study aeronautical engineering.
I didn't know that.
And then he subsequently went to Berkeley and almost single-handedly brought back the jazz tradition from America.
So it was Berkeley.
That's where
he studied jazz.
That's right.
Yeah, and he got into the Cuban, Puerto Rican sound as well there.
And he sort of brings this whole thing back. Right. Because, I suppose a lot of people assume that the jazz found its way to Ethiopia from Europe, but it wasn't. He almost single-handedly brought it back himself.
Yes.
And fused together the two cultures. Mm. And it's quite amazing that could be almost attributed to one person, artist in the history of a nation. And so the fact that it was almost all destroyed, or, that music scene was almost destroyed in the late 1960s and early 1970s by the Marxist regime.
Yes.
Is just, it's diabolical, really.
But,
Well, I guess the logical question that comes to mind is that, these learnings that the indigenous music of Ethiopia and the cross-cultural collaborations with Western jazz, are there some learnings for Australian indigenous culture and Australian jazz there?
That's a really, really big question, isn't it? Well, okay, there's a great example of some jazz crossover with Australian indigenous music right now with Peter Knight from the Australian Art Orchestra, and he's based out of Melbourne, a trumpet player. And I just saw they're doing a gig. He's doing a gig with some, I think, two indigenous musicians, maybe a female singer and a udaki player, maybe. I'm not sure. I really should check this out because it looks like a fascinating project. And Aviva Endean, who's a Melbourne-based bass clarinetist, improvising bass clarinetist, more in the avant-garde improvised scene. And also Paul Grabowski has done some great collaborations. So, look, there is some crossover. As for Indigenous jazz, I just don't know.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated to see if there is some out there, and if there is, I'd love to hear it. As for Australian jazz itself, well, you know, there's a huge amount of that. You know, obviously you play a lot of that. You do mostly play Australian
that's right.
jazz. And Peter Nelson also is a great sort of proponent of that. And there's definitely a sound. Bernie McGann was possibly the leading light of that for people to go, hang on, that where in the world does that come from? And so there's a few examples of that where it's a great, it's a really interesting thing.
The band, Mr. Ott, you know, you've got some fine players with you, and they've been with you almost since the start. Ellen Kirkwood, the trumpet player, Daniel Pliner, the keyboard, the pianist, Ben Panucci, the guitarist. These are people that are just as adept in other jazz genres as what yourself is. Ellen Kirkwood and a number of different ensembles.
Yeah,
Ben Panucci's just as likely to be playing with Jeff Bull in a pub on a Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Your brother Eden Ottignon, Carlos Adura, the drummer. What are the traits in these artists that they're bringing to the sound that you want to achieve?
Yeah, that's an interesting question too. I'll start with Carlos. And Carlos and I worked in Derib's band, or you know, we played together in Derib, the Ambassadors ensemble, and Carlos also toured with us to Ethiopia when we did that tour, and so he, when I started out the band, he had that he had those rhythms right there, and he had that sound, and then there's something about his playing that I felt really comfortable with. With this ensemble, and so it meant that when I was writing, or when we were writing, I really felt that the drums were going to sound the way I felt them or heard them, and so that's for Carlos. With Ellen, I met her when she used to come and see the Sun Chasers play, which is a six piece that Eden and I had. Eden started, my brother, and we had already started playing a few Ethiopian things and a bit of Afrobeat and reggae and stuff. And she would come along and jam with us. And I thought, well, hang on, you know, this is great. And she started getting some of these lines under her fingers. And then when I needed a second horn for the band, I thought she would be great at learning some of these more sort of complicated, like in the traditional Ethiopian way, and some of the African, and there's a few little trills and little sort of ornaments, really. They're ornaments that they're unusual and they take a while to get used to. There's a certain phrasing, and so she picked it up really quick.
Yeah.
And that was so. We've been able to sort of build up a language there and a sound. And now when we play together, it's just like a glove, and it just fits really well, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's that. And then the other guys like Daniel Pliner also played with Derib for a while, and Ben and I. Ben, I mean, I just love Ben's playing. So and I knew he was enthusiastic. He really wanted to play, and I was like, this is going to be great too. So yeah. And now I'm actually using Dave Symes on bass, who's an old friend of mine from uni days, and because Eden's relocated to Berlin.
Oh, okay, right.
Yeah.
Now it is something that has maybe it's because we haven't had seen any tours for like 2 years, but I've just noticed that there's a little bit more energy in the touring area at the moment, especially for jazz.
Yeah.
Is organising a tour these days any more difficult, or is it any easier than what it was pre-COVID?
I'd say it'd be the same, except for the fact that their grants are slightly easier to get now. And that just can only be because it's part of the stimulus package.
Mm.
So they've just, I don't know whether there's just literally more money on the table and there's more grants to get, or whether they're making it easier to get the grants. I'm not sure. I guess it's a bit of both. But yeah, that's a big part of why I think there's a lot more tours happening right now. Because actually, if it wasn't for that, there probably would be even less because people would be like, why would we go out and tour now? There's just no way we could do it. People aren't going to come, not only because of COVID, but because of various national, you know, disasters, natural disasters that are happening. I mean, we're not really doing the Northern Rivers, but I have heard of, I think it's Alcyon. I can't remember the name of that. But they're touring up there right now.
Oh,
they're doing the Northern Rivers right now.
Yep.
Which is amazing because, like I said, you'd think, why would you do that now? Mm. Like, people are, like, so many people around the area are homeless now.
Mm.
But there's also so many people who need music. They need entertainment. They need something to, something exciting, something they don't want to feel left out.
Mm.
So this is, I think it's great that the tours are happening. Whether or not there's enough of, you know, the government's doing enough, I just don't know. I'm not qualified to say. I definitely know that there's a lot of angry people up in the Northern Rivers who are saying the government have not supported them enough and that they there's a pathetic amount of accommodation options for people now, and the government are just like
washing their hands.
Yeah, well, they're saying they're doing something, but it's the reality is they haven't done enough yet. But, you know, like, I think a lot of – I think they probably will get around to it. It's just not quick enough. But things like this, once they actually happen and once they actually roll out, they're an absolute boon for the scene.
Now, we have featured on the program previously on numerous occasions the Drop It Like It's Ott, and I think that was the first album.
Yeah.
How have you seen the music develop? How has the music changed on this latest album from when we were playing the music, the Drop It Like It's Ott?
There's a lot less obvious Ethiopian references as the albums have. I think when we started out, it was a huge influence, and as it's progressed, I've really wanted to make sure that we're starting to develop more of a personal sound and more of a... So there's less of that. I think that just the way I've written this last album is the process has changed. It's been, I would make mixtapes or playlists of songs that I really like at the time, then compose in the studio on my own with a saxophone and a keyboard, make demos, take it into the rehearsal studio, then the other five people in the band flesh it out, and then come up with arrangements on the spot, come up with new parts, record that, take it back into the studio, edit it out, finalize the arrangements, and then go into the studio to record them. Maybe we'll go out and do a couple of gigs to test them out, road test them out. And that's become, I really like that process now, and that's, you know, meant for a much more cohesive band original sound. Mm. Whereas the first album was just, I don't know, like some of them were just written and then handed to them and just play this. One of the tracks is, I just said, Ben, can you write a song for the album? And he wrote a song for the album, and there it is. And we still play it today. It's great. But different process for as we've gone.
Yeah. Thanks very much for joining us in the studio.
No worries, mate.
Matt.
Yeah.
It's been really good to catch up again after 13 years.
Yeah.
Matthew Ottignon.
Thanks, mate.